direct from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
The lingering housing hangover. I'm Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti on this Memorial Day weekend. Glad you could spend some time with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
New research from the real estate information site Zillow finds that at the end of the first quarter, almost 19% of U.S. homeowners with a mortgage were underwater on their loans.
How to tell if someone is lying to you when you're texting or emailing.
A fast food giant is being forced to again defend its marketing practices involving kids. Find out what's going on at McDonald's.
And appealing to your sense of smell as a marketing tool.
There are lots of businesses that are now using scents to sort of either entice you to walk in, you know, think about Cinnabon, or just sort of set an ambiance, you know, as they would with lighting or music or some other element of the store.
Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Nassauer on the newest ways stores are trying to get your attention. She's here later in the hour. If it's Memorial Day weekend, we must be talking about our soldiers, right? There's a perfect tie into this story since May is Mental Health Awareness Month. You may have heard about the Real Warriors campaign, which aims to help service members and their families who are coping with psychological health concerns. For more, we're joined by Navy Captain Anthony Arita. Captain, explain the broader campaign.
Well, the Real Warriors campaign is a multimedia public information campaign designed to promote health seeking. We really acknowledge that it's not uncommon for people to have psychological health concerns and symptoms and conditions, but oftentimes there may be a reluctance to seek help, a reluctance to put themselves out there that they might have a condition. And so what we try to do is try to dispel stigma or those negative perceptions, and we try to promote awareness of all the various resources that we have available to meet various psychological health needs.
Please tell me that we're making progress on this front. I know it's been a long battle.
We are better off than we were before, but still there's more to do. And while we have a very robust resource through our Real Warriors campaign website, and that's realwarriors.net, you'll see now through that resource that we've got really a great lineup of video profiles and vignettes. We've got a host of tools and other information resources to help people increase their understanding of psychological health conditions and the treatments that are available. And through the video profiles, we note across the services and across different ranks that people have reached out, have demonstrated the strength and the courage it takes, and have really demonstrated by their example that treatment is effective and people recover. So while we've made tremendous progress, still there's more to do, and we encourage everyone out there, our military leaders, our family members, to really join in supporting the promotion of a culture of support for psychological health. And we try to do that this month through Mental Health Awareness Month and through our campaign year-round.
We're speaking with Navy Captain Anthony Arita about the Real Warriors campaign. How difficult is it to get a soldier to open up and admit that he or she might need help? Because during training, right? I mean, these guys and gals become the toughest of the tough.
Right. We recognize that having that kind of warrior mindset, it's critical on the battlefield. It's critical as one goes to war. One has to be able to, have that warrior ethos and that warrior mentality in order to get the job done. But as they return from deployment, the context is different. We're no longer in that environment of threat, and yet people might commonly experience, again, many of those signs in their bodily responses, in their mindset, that there's still a need to be on guard. And so that's where we try to, address that phenomenon. We try to address the possible changes that people experience when they return from deployment by being able to recognize their need to attend to these things.
So you're a neuropsychologist. What are the signs that maybe friends and family of some of these warriors should be looking for if we suspect something might be up?
Oftentimes, when people come back from a battle zone, combat deployment experience, there may be signs that there's a continued posture as if there's a threat in the environment. So there may be an overreactivity to loud noises, sounds. There may be a tendency to be very, very vigilant as to threats in the environment. There may be a physiological response that gets people kind of amped up and, again, in their go-to-war kind of readiness, but, again, out of place, out of context in our in-garrison environment. And so people may exhibit signs of being being preoccupied. Maybe they're thinking about things that they've seen during the deployment experience. Maybe they, again, have a really difficult time relaxing and getting into their family and be-at-home mode. So when family members see that, when leaders recognize that their troops are having difficulty making that transition, again, that's when it's a time to encourage, you know, people to take steps to get help, to support them in their efforts to do so, and again, to know that they can be fully confident that when they do engage, you know, our treatment resources and our helping resources, that people can expect good results, that this is not going to result in adverse impacts to one's career, and I think they'll see through the video profiles available through the RealWarriors.net website that people oftentimes continue down that path of success in the military and across their lives.
Thanks, Captain. Navy Captain Anthony Arita. It is 12 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Thanks for spending part of your holiday weekend with us. Here's the latest news on the housing market, perhaps explaining recent sluggishness in the recovery. Wall Street Journal reporter Connor Daugherty says nearly 10 million U.S. households remain stuck in homes worth less than their mortgage, and a similar number have so little equity they can't meet the expenses of selling a home. Connor, what are we looking at?
There are a lot of good things about the real estate market the last few years. Prices are up, foreclosures are down, and with all that, you know, positivity in the market, it's hard to forget this one sort of startling, painful fact, and that's that there are still about 10 million people out there who are living in homes that are worth less than the mortgage on them. And that number is actually closer to, say, 20 million if you add in people who are basically underwater, meaning they have like 5% equity in their home. And the reason is, you know, it would be hard to sell that home without writing a check for something, you know, a broker fee or a closing cost. And not to say nothing of the fact that many people, count on using their equity to buy the next home. And so what that all adds up to is a whole bunch of people are just sort of stuck in the home, and they're just waiting until prices go up higher, right? And this helps explain a lot of the problems in the real estate market right now. We don't have a super high inventory of homes for sale, and that's because a lot of people just aren't going to list. You know, and prices are up, but homeowners are being very stubborn. And one of the reasons they're being very stubborn is they sort of have to be. They're not going to sell the home until they don't have to write a check or take a loss. But I think that, you know, there's this whole other class of people that, you know, they didn't lose their job. They're not behind on their mortgage. They're just regular people like you and me, but they were lucky to dodge the economic problem. You know, everything's, you know, basically fine, except for that they can't sell this home, at least without taking a loss. And a lot of people don't want to take the hit to their credit score.
What percentage of homeowners is this?
It's about 19%. This is homeowners with a mortgage. I should clarify that. So there's, you know, something like a third of homeowners in the country just own the house outright. You know, your parents, you know, older people, you know, people who've been in the home for a long time, you know. But amongst people with a mortgage, about 40% are still effectively underwater.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Connor Daugherty. Is this number going down?
Yes, it is going down strongly, and it's doing, it's getting much better. But I think one of the things we have to remember is that it's gone down pretty strongly over the past year or two as home prices have gone up. That said, it's not, as home prices have kind of moderated over the past year or the past few months, it's gone down less fast. It's not getting worse. So I think the bottom line here is that even though it's getting a lot better, it's a problem that's going to be with us for some time. I think that, when we talk about the broader real estate recovery, I think we need to forget about all these interrelated things in the real estate market and focus, shift our vision a little bit to jobs. You know, like when jobs get a lot better and when income growth gets a lot better, you will start to see that feed into the real estate recovery a little bit more.
Thanks, Connor. Wall Street Journal reporter Connor Daugherty in Washington. 19 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. It is time for Gina Cervetti.
If you're hitting the road this Memorial Day weekend, then you may be joining the almost 32 million Americans expected to travel at least 50 miles from home, according to AAA. The Auto Club says this is the most people traveling by car for the holiday in almost a decade. You can expect to pay about the same for gas this year as you did last year. This Memorial Day weekend marks the 27th annual Rolling Thunder Rally, a huge event in which motorcycle riders from around the country converge on Washington, D.C. to raise awareness for POWs, soldiers that remain missing in action, and other veterans. We'll watch for several economic reports during the upcoming holiday shortened trading week, and the biggie will be the government's second estimate of growth for this year's first quarter.
It's still not going to be particularly good. It'll be under 1%. Maybe we'll see 0.6 or, if we're lucky, 0.7, but not a whole lot more than that.
Economist Joel Naroff this next week also brings reports on sales on pending home sales. This past week, we got the update on sales of new and existing homes. Microsoft is billing its new Surface Pro 3 as a laptop killer, even coming up with a new term, lappability. This is a market that has been dominated by Apple and devices that use Google's Android. The new Surface has a relatively large 12-inch screen. Google is number one in compensation and benefits in a new Glassdoor survey. Allison Willoughby with Glassdoor says employees ranked their companies and the search giant was number one.
Google has always been on the cutting edge of compensation and benefits, and really more on the benefits. They were the first company to start serving food to everyone 24/7. They've got an amazing array of cutting edge benefits, and they're always rolling out new ones.
Costco came in second and Facebook was third. Revealing a lot of personal information on Facebook may be a sign of loneliness. According to a new Australian study, it found that more than 79% of users who describe themselves as lonely disclosed personal information, compared with 65% of other users. For example, most users who describe themselves as lonely shared their relationship status publicly instead of restricting that to their friends list.
You can spot those, can't you?
Gordon, if only some of the sharing was as innocuous as just saying, hey, I'm available, or hey, I'm taken. Right?
Yes.
Some of the stuff that you see on Facebook, you could probably do without.
That's
then
true.
Again, nobody's forcing us to be there.
It is easy to spot the attention seekers, though, I think. Hey, Gina, 22 minutes after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Thanks for being with us. How can you tell if the person you're talking to online is telling the truth? Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein has been looking for answers. Elizabeth, what have you found?
It's interesting. How can you tell? So many people go online. So many relationships even start via print, really. Lots of people are doing online dating. But more than that, we have colleagues that, you know, we may exchange a lot of emails with, texts with, but we never see. You know, so there's a lot of communication that's going on in words and not face-to-face. So how can you tell, though, if you met online, your old, you know, high school buddy who reconnected with you on Facebook, or say even your boss in an email? How can you tell if they're telling the truth? That's what I wanted to look at. Research shows that about 90%, as much as 90% of our communication is nonverbal. It's body language. So it's our posture, our gestures, contact, its tone of voice. So take all of that away with the written word, you know, with that last 10%, you know, how can you tell us from being deceptive?
Wow. All right. So what are some of the signs we should be looking for?
There's things they do that they don't mean to do. They're subconscious, but they do them anyway. And one of them is big distancing techniques. So someone who face-to-face is lying to you might want to desk or table in between you, might cross their arms across their chest. A woman might take her handbag and put it in her lap. And they're going to do things that sort of create some kind of physical distance. And it turns out in print, in text or email, if they're chatting with you online, they're going to use that same distancing technique, just be in words. So they might not tell you exactly where they were. A big thing is they won't use the I pronoun. They won't say, I did this. Tell you exactly where they are. Hey, where are you right now? One thing I've written about before, phrases I call tee-ups. This is a big one to look for in print. These are phrases like, to be honest, I'm just saying, I hate to tell you this. These kinds of things where they're distancing themselves.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein about how to tell if someone is telling the truth when you're communicating by email or text. how much of this stuff, too, can be, say, just a misunderstanding, right? Because not everybody's a professional communicator when it comes to texting, especially if you're using shorthand and all that stuff.
Oh, exactly. And anybody over the age of, say, 15 or 22 or something, I don't know what the age is now, makes me feel older and older, but, you know, it's not that good at texting anyway. We all should just stop it. But, you know, so there could be misunderstandings, but in a misunderstanding, you can write back and clarify, hey, did you say you were not the person who was leaving the office last night and left the door open, clarifying. If they continue ahead, you need to pay attention. And so, for example, you know, back in prehistoric times, if we heard, you know, if an early human heard a growling noise, it was best for that early human to believe that that was a big scary animal and run, not to start analyzing the other ways that this may be true. But now, say we have somebody, so we have this truth bias. We want to sort of believe what's in front of us is what's in front of us. We want to believe what the person is telling us is true. But we need to pay a little bit more attention, because now with online, we also have stronger reasons with all this communication that's written to believe it. We want to believe that person on the dating site who looks so attractive and seems perfect is perfect. So we will override our gut instinct that this person is not telling me the truth.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Bernstein. By the way, she adds that first and foremost, if an email or text exchange feels off, ask the person if he or she would mind switching immediately to phone or Skype. And how about this? She says a slightly more skeptical request is to ask for a real-time photo stamped with the time and date. Wow. 30 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend. Coming up next, a new tool for helping young autistic adults train for jobs.
You just watched the market close in Shanghai. New York doesn't open for a couple of hours, so there's time to fit in a session at the gym, squeeze in a haircut, go hit a few balls at the driving range, shoot off some emails, and maybe even breakfast across town. And you'll still be the first one in the office. You're always ready to go the extra mile. Fortunately, so is your Cadillac. With Cadillac Certified Service, our experts make sure your Cadillac is as ready to go as you are.
For a limited time, get a $100 mail-in rebate debit card on a set of four select brand-name tires at your Cadillac dealer. See participating dealer for eligible tire brands and details. Rebate form must be postmarked by June 30th, 2014. Allow 6 to 8 weeks for delivery of debit card. Offer ends May 31st, 2014.
Powered by the most trusted name in journalism, you're listening to the Wall Street Journal This Weekend.
Thanks for being with us on this Memorial Day weekend. Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti coming up this half hour. Why arts writers are taking shots at a certain singer's physique. Who are these people? Well, that report in about 15 minutes. Researchers at Northwestern University have found a new tool for helping young autistic adults train for jobs critical for helping them get some independence. The program called Molly involves a simulated interview. Wall Street Journal reporter Shirley Wong says knowing what an employer wants to hear can make all the difference during a job interview. And for adults with an autism spectrum disorder, those answers can be harder to come by. Shirley, take us through some of the research.
Well, finding employment is one of the biggest challenges for adults with autism spectrum disorders, and there are a lot of programs out there that are trying to help individuals get work. There's been not that much research, though, to show that these programs work, and so there's a sort of growing amount of evidence to suggest that there are some programs out there that do seem to improve skills, like interview skills and self-confidence, and that may actually help improve employment success for these individuals.
Got it. All right, so how are they doing that?
Well, so there are a number of different programs out there. Again, you know, we're talking here about some of the research evidence that's looking into these programs. And one in particular that recently had a study that was published on it, uses a virtual reality job coach. They call her Molly. But the neat thing about her is that she was designed by researchers who originally were trying to teach FBI agents to interrogate witnesses. And what they've basically been able to design is
individual, which they call Molly, who can ask all kinds of questions based on the application that an individual fills out. So if they have gaps in their work history, for instance, then this Molly coach or interviewer can ask the individual to explain, you know, why are you, what are these work gaps, and sort of help them learn how to answer those questions. And also, the virtual reality coach can be programmed to different levels of niceness, so they can start off, she can start off being nice and ask easy questions, and then increasingly become more challenging, again, sort of helping people with autism learn how to navigate these situations, including situations where someone in a work situation might actually ask an illegal question, for instance, and trying to help individuals with autism figure out, you know, how do you answer the question like that appropriately without actually having to give out information that might actually even be illegal.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Shirley Wong in London about helping autistic adults find work. It's interesting you brought up that subject, because I was going to ask, does this virtual reality job coach ask things like questions about their condition, for example, which I think, as you were saying, might be illegal?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I actually don't know if they ask specifically about that condition, but it is an area of debate about whether someone with autism should disclose that information. I think there's quite different camps that say whether that's a good thing or not. But what Molly will help the applicant do is that there are actually a set number of responses that an applicant can decide, can pick, and then Molly will basically give the applicant information about whether that was a good choice or what could be a better choice. And so if the applicant is faced with a question such as, do you have a disability, or some kind of question that's inappropriate, the program would have different choices of responses. And again, if the applicant picked one that was incorrect, basically, or not as effective, then Molly would give that person feedback so that in the next time that question came around, then they might be able to answer that question even better.
Okay. When you say pick an answer, you're talking about like on a computer, like they're choosing a multiple choice answer to
Okay. Yeah, so it is like a multiple choice. I mean, there are a number of responses, but there are sort of different levels of responses in terms of, you know, less effective answers to more effective answers.
Thanks, Shirley. Wall Street Journal reporter Shirley Wong, who's based out of the London Bureau. 22 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend. The opera world is buzzing over a larger singer in the UK who was criticized for her weight. And now several singers have weighed in. On a related note, there's a series on Ovation that's about a group of plus-size women doing Swan Lake. The story is from Wall Street Journal reporter Pia Catton. Pia, who's the singer getting this criticism about her body?
So it's a singer named Tara Erhalt, who was in a production of De Rose and Cavalier in Glyndebourne in the UK. And the reviews about her performance, some of them mentioned her singing, but quite a number of them mentioned her physique, calling her dumpy and a chubby bundle of puppy fat.
Jeez.
Right. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, here we are in this day and age. This girl, from every photo that I've seen, and of course I wasn't there at the production, but from every photo I've seen, it's not big at all. And it's kind of strange. I mean, here's the thing about opera. There is a way in which having a wider chest and some girth actually helps you. I mean, it's a legitimate part of singing, because the body acts as kind of a bellows system, right? You let a lot of breath in and then you release it, and that control is part of what makes a singer great, because they release all this air, and then the air kind of goes through the, you know, the chest and the throat, and that is able to push out the sound into a giant opera hall. So you want that. And if we're going to be critical of women and their size, even men on stage, I mean, I think we might be heading toward an era of some inferior singing.
All right, so critics of the critics here have said,
oh,
what,
the critics. Oh, I mean, they're calling them names, and it's been an insult fest, I would say.
Yeah.
It's kind of amusing to watch, and though, of course, it's not amusing for the purpose or for the original concept. But also, interestingly, there have been some female opera singers explaining why weight and why looseness in the chest is important and valuable. So, you know, maybe that message gets out there of just why it is important for a singer to have a certain type of physique, and maybe that is not the physique of a dancer. Mm. You don't want a singer to have that, you know, very lithe, thin body. that you see on a ballet stage.
Yeah.
That's not helpful.
Never considered that. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Pia Catton. So what has Tara's reaction been, if any, to all this?
Judging from Twitter, she's been pretty quiet about it all. And she's done a couple, I believe she's done some interviews in the UK. But, it's got to take its toll. And I've talked to opera singers in the past. They're pretty resilient.
When does it end with this, right?
Right.
And is this mostly guys, I presume, who are making
right.
these critiques of her body?
And, look, critics of any art form have a pretty unusual position. Here in the U.S., we had a situation a couple years ago where a dancer in New York City Ballet and in a production of The Nutcracker got a lot of criticism from the New York Times critic, the lead dancer and the lead male dancer, her partner. He said something like, it looked like she had too many sugar plums. And that started a whole round of media attacks. She ended up, I think, on one of the daytime talk shows talking about it. And it was in her life, and I've interviewed her, Jennifer Ringer. She's written an autobiography. She had a weight problem. And that whole episode was, in a way, it was just like, forget it. I've already dealt with this for her. So she went through a lot.
I guess I'd ask these critics, do they have daughters?
Right.
What kind of message are you sending
right.
here?
Right. It's a terrible yeah. message. I should also say about dance, there is a upcoming television series called Big Ballet, in which a group of plus-size dancers in the UK were auditioned and trained to take place in a Swan Lake. So this is actually a fascinating series. It's on Ovation starting next week.
Wow.
And it's not meant to be funny either. It's meant to be serious. And it's meant to show that ballet, is a beautiful art form that people can participate in no matter what size they are.
Okay. How's it being received? Do we know any word?
Well, it was a big hit in the UK, and we're going to find out next week here in the US.
If it's been received well in the UK, does that often translate into a positive reception here?
Often it does. And the truth is, our country has a weight problem and
yeah.
it's hard to deal with seeing certain people in certain roles. Look at baseball players. They seem kind of dumpy out there. I hate to have such a double standard, but they are professional athletes. And I don't see why having that big beer belly helps them. Opera singers, it helps. And in the case of Big Ballet, we're talking about an amateur effort that was meant to expand the accessibility of an art form to other people.
Thanks, Pia. Wall Street Journal reporter Pia Catton, who's based in New York. 14 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Thanks for spending part of your Memorial Day weekend with us. It's 11 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Once again, here's Gina Cervetti.
Well, the stock market's fear gauge has fallen to its lowest level in more than a year. The fear gauge is the Chicago Board Options Exchange Volatility Index. It's a measure of trader expectations for price swings in the S&P 500. And many traders say they're picking up on little fear lately, citing several factors, including near-record stock prices, low interest rates, and steady, if not great, U.S. growth. This next week is a shortened trading week after Monday's Memorial Day holiday. We will, however, get the second estimate of economic growth for earlier this year, the GDP report for the first quarter. We also watch for other updates on durable goods orders, for example, and consumer confidence. Economist Joel Naroff says those durables could prove disappointing.
Not simply because the economy is weakening, but these data just do bounce around a lot. So I expect to see some growth, but nothing special, especially given how strong it had been.
McDonald's is again defending the fast food company's marketing practices involving children, reacting to renewed criticisms as the company takes the wraps off a new Happy Meal mascot. The mascot, dubbed Happy, will be used to promote more healthful options, including apples and yogurt. Although the boxy character did seem to get a cold reception from health advocates and on social media. If you're like a lot of parents, many of your purchasing decisions revolve around the kids. And a new survey from Coldwell Banker finds this is especially true among the nation's youngest parents. Dr. Roby Ludwig is with Coldwell Banker.
In the past, parents would make a decision, and then the rest of the family would have to deal with that decision. Generation X parents, the millennial parents, they're more inclined to consider their kids.
79% of parents aged 18 to 34 said most of their major buying decisions revolved around the children. For Generation X, or those between 35 and 49, that percentage was 70%. Compare that, Gordon, to the just over half of boomer parents who said that this was true when they raised their family.
Well, it, in some ways, though, it can be like the inmates running the asylum. And you got to be careful with how far you go with that.
Yeah.
That's
you think it's a case of apples versus oranges in the generational differences?
No. No, I think there's some, I don't know, for whatever reason, parents feel that kids have to play a role. I don't know why. That's a shift in thinking for sure.
Well, it's good to involve the kids.
I agree. Good to involve them.
Clearly,
they can't carry
too much
weight.
Sometimes have a change.
True.
As the song goes.
8 minutes in front of the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Thanks for being with us. There's a method to the madness. You know those smells emanating from certain stores that catch your attention? That's no accident. Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Nassauer has a look at how stores craft what you smell when you walk by. Sarah, explain the trend.
Well, as you might have noticed, as you're walking through the mall or down the street, there are lots of businesses that are now using scents to either entice you to walk in, you know, think about Cinnabon, or just sort of set an ambiance, you know, as they would with lighting or music or some other element of the store.
So what's involved technologically with this?
Well, if you happen to be cooking, usually those businesses tend to rely just on the scent of whatever they're cooking. But lots of other folks that don't have food involved are using little scent diffusers, or they actually sort of mist scent through the air conditioning heating vents or, you know, the ventilation system of the business. And so they're spritzing out these little puffs of scent every so often.
Wow. So who's doing it? What kind of different shops?
It's a wide variety of places. Restaurants, retail stores, I think Abercrombie & Finch, everyone's had that experience walking by that store. Hotels have really embraced this, but even healthcare, nursing homes, places like that have embraced this as a way to sort of pump in some brown sugar, homey smell into their lobby so that when people are visiting and decide if they want to stay there, they feel like it's a homey place.
I presume at this point there's a direct correlation with an increase in sales.
Well, that's interesting. So I talked quite a bit to Cinnabon for this story, and for them, they definitely see this as very, very key to their business. I mean, one of the primary parts of their business is making sure that aroma gets out there in the mall. They specifically choose to be in malls, airports, inside settings, not outdoors, so the scent doesn't just disappear into the air. They're very intentional about making sure that smell is there because they believe it really boosts sales.
Wow.
But these other folks that are sort of using it as ambiance, there doesn't seem to be good sort of research that points to it directly boosting sales. Yet they think it still is good for branding, marketing, and a lot of small, you know, individual store owners believe that it does.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Nassauer. So sights and sounds, are they sort of ahead of the game versus the sense of smell?
Yes, definitely. But smell is a pretty intense emotional sense, as everyone knows. So I think that for the folks using it, they're hoping that that works. There's a lot of complication, though, to doing this. As more and more stores do it, you're getting sort of more scent competition, especially in mall settings. So this now makes its way into lease agreements with landlords and malls. It's regulated sort of how far you can push your scent out into common areas.
Jeez.
Some of the clothing retailers that are really into scent, like Bath and Body Works and others,
They
will actually stipulate in their leases that they can't be within a certain radius of a food business like a Cinnabon because they don't want to have competing smells invading their space. So once everyone does it, it gets a little bit complex.
Thanks, Sarah. Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Nassauer. For Gina Cervetti, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to the Wall Street Journal This Weekend.